conflict with the United States government and with U.S. imperialism, we tend to think that we're always the bad guys in these kinds of situations. And certainly the treatment of Omar Khadr lived up to that. However, Canada was not separate from all of that. They were very resistant. The government was resistant to bringing Omar back. And in fact, during the time that he was in Guantanamo, they sent their own intelligence officers to interrogate Omar. And during those, before those, like the frequent flyer program, which meant sleep deprivation, being moved from one location to another. In addition, he was held in solitary. There were many different difficult things that were done to him to soften him up for the interrogations. There is a video of one of his interrogations that you can watch if you do interrogation. I don't recommend it for anyone who has sensitive feelings, because I watched it and I was in tears after 5 minutes and had to turn it off. You're basically seeing a teenage boy who being interrogated, not in a violent way at that time, but his emotions were so at the surface, it's very hard to watch. Well, it looks like we do have Dennis Edney with us on the line, so I want to welcome you, Dennis Edney.
Thank you very much.
I'm so glad to have you. You know, ever since they did the trial of, I won't even call it a trial, they did the kangaroo court, the military commissions court in Guantanamo, and Omar Khadr was forced to accept a plea agreement and sentenced to an additional 8 years in prison. I found that I began to lose touch with this story, and I've been wondering for a while, what happened to Omar Khadr? And so that's the question we're dealing with today, Dennis, and I know that you know that you're up on it all the time. And so if you would start with when Omar was repatriated to Canada, the Canadian government definitely resisted his return.
Canadian government what?
Resisted his return.
Absolutely. Omar Khadr returned to Canada on September the 29th of 2012. And that was almost a year beyond what was agreed between Canada and the United States. The United States had agreed that Omar Khadr, at the end of that fictional trial, would serve 1 year in Guantanamo and be returned home. And Canada did not honor that. In fact, it took the American government to put pressure on Canada to take Omar back. And so Omar spent an extra year in Guantanamo, contrary to what the initial agreement was. But in any event, he returns to Canada, and he was imprisoned at Millhaven Institution, which is a maximum security penitentiary for some of our worst offenders in Canada. We have such people such as Bernardo and others who have killed, whom you call serial killers. And Omar was placed there because the Canadian government designated him or classified him as a maximum security prisoner, that he was a threat to both Canada and also to the institution itself. That is, that prison with very serious psychopathic killers. They had to be frightened of him.
Well, and there had been more than one psychological opinion about Omar that said that he was a gentle, easygoing, got along with guards, etc. So this classification as a severe danger for someone who hadn't even been out of any kind of prison since he was 15 years old is pretty absurd.
Well, even the Undersecretary of State for the United States classified Omar in a letter to the Canadian government that he was a minimum risk, he was no problem at all. And who better to know the character of Omar Khadr than those people who had imprisoned him for over 10 years in Guantanamo Bay? And you're right, of course, there are numerous psychiatric and psychological psychometric testings that took place of Omar Khadr, all attesting to his good nature. And there was even a letter that we received from a former guard in Guantanamo attesting to Omar Khadr's good character. But notwithstanding that, the Canadian government then locked him away for the first 7 months in solitary confinement. So all they were doing was continuing the same abuses that he had experienced in Guantanamo.
Dennis Edney, then, had he been, when he was that last year that he was kept an extra long time in Guantanamo, was he also in solitary there?
Yes.
And he had been in a lower level release prior to that, prior to his military commission, isn't that correct?
It got worse for Omar, if one could say that, about Guantanamo. After the so-called trial, Omar Khadr was moved from the cages and put into one of these torture prisons. My memory's going from...
One of the camps that's more like a individual lockups, solitary lockups.
Well, you know, in Guantanamo, there's the cages, and then they're built of concrete, and they're in the desert, and I've been in two of them. And Omar Khadr has spent a good part of his life in those prisons, and they're designed, as the Pentagon describes, for enhanced interrogation techniques. And so Omar was then moved back into one of those prisons. And what the public does not know is that he was then they continued to interrogate him post-trial for 9 days at a time and 9 hours a day with two different teams of FBI and other types of security personnel questioning him.
I really hadn't heard that. I didn't realize they continued to interrogate him.
Well, that led to my firing, actually, because I had gone back to Guantanamo. I had had some understanding that he had been interviewed and interrogated, and I had been given a very different understanding of that, those interrogations by a particular military defense counsel, which was incorrect, if not misleading. And when I arrived in Guantanamo, Omar, I was threatened that I couldn't ask any questions about any interrogation that would take place. And every time I tried that, I was either taken out of the cell, and at one point I was locked in a cell for a period of time. And Omar finally told me what was going on, and he looked very pale and very sick. And, you know, the irony, of course, or the foolishness of it all is that how often do you have to interrogate someone? Omar Khadr has been interrogated over 400 times since in his stay in Guantanamo.
I actually, to be honest, I don't understand its purpose except punitive. I can't believe that they have from anybody that they've held that long and tortured that much and kept in those conditions. I don't believe that the interrogators can believe that there's actually information that has not yet been pulled out of this human being. It seems to me it must be purely punitive, but I'm really baffled other than that.
But one also has to question the Military Defense Council who allowed this to take place.
Absolutely. What was his name? Was that Kubler?
But that just is a background to the consistent abuse that Omar Khadr has suffered since early childhood. And that continued in Canada. And so when he arrived in Canada, he was locked away for 7 months in solitary confinement. And on the last day of his solitary confinement, a guard asked if he would like to work on the food line. And Omar said, of course. And the guard said, well, your job is to hand out. And Omar went on to this food line. And for someone such as myself, who's been in the criminal justice system for many long years, the kitchen and the food line are amongst the most passed along, messages are passed along, and so on. And the guard told Omar that he was only allowed to give one pasty of butter to each inmate. And so a particular inmate requested all the butter. Omar told him what the rules were. This inmate took offense to that, tried to stab Omar, and then put a contract on him.
Boy.
So I was always suspicious of why this guard had put Omar in such a dangerous position. And Omar is, you know, he's a man boy in many ways. And so Omar went back to solitary confinement, and then I was able to negotiate and have him released, or not released, but transferred from Millhaven Prison to Edmonton, Alberta, to our, to where we have a maximum security prison, and that's where he has been remaining since.
And have they, I believe that I read, and I just for the audience, this is Linda Olson-Osterlund for KBOO, and I'm speaking with attorney Dennis Edmonton, Dennis Edney from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, about Omar Khadr, the former child soldier locked in Guantanamo and now repatriated to Canada. In the situation that he's in, you mentioned a little bit earlier that you were fired at one point. I'm assuming you're not still fired because you're actively advocating for him legally again. Can you talk about what happened during that process?
It's very difficult to do so because I've been threatened with libel by the military, but here's what I'll tell you is that pressure was put on. Well, first of all, I was not allowed back in Guantanamo. So let me step back. Let me tell you the answer. The answer is quite quickly, is this. I was furious that Omar Khadr had been treated that way. And I was even more furious at the military defense team allowing this and misrepresenting what was going on. And so what I said to them, which was a mistake, it was a tactical mistake, I threatened these military personnel by telling them that I had been invited to speak at the convention for the American civil trial lawyers. And I intended to talk about this fiction called a trial, how poorly it was, how badly represented Omar was, had received. And in addition to that, I also intended to say that Omar Khadr had been eviscerated of any defense whatsoever, including, I said I also intend to talk about his mistreatment since the trial. Well, Omar will tell you that he was pressured by these military personnel to fire me and fire my co-counsel, Nate Whitland. And so the day before I was speaking to the American bar, I received a typewritten letter essentially gagging me from speaking about Omar Khadr whatsoever and signed by Omar at the bottom. What I wasn't aware of, and so over a year passed before I ever heard from Omar again. And in the meantime, what I hadn't been told was Omar had gone on a hunger strike to get me into Guantanamo and had contacted Red Cross and various other groups to get me in there. But I was blocked from ever getting back into Guantanamo.
In fact, Omar participated in hunger strikes twice, didn't he?
Yes.
With other, and that was also something I hadn't realized, that he had joined in those hunger strikes. Hunger strikes have proved to be the only and the most important weapon that the prisoners have. And by weapon, I don't mean harming people. I mean the only thing they have to defend themselves against the treatment they're receiving and indefinite detention.
It's the only form of protest other than killing yourself, which by committing suicide, which occurs and is very difficult to do because you're chained all the time. Is and
so,
when we talk about protesting, it's quite a horrible, it's not as simple as not eating.
No.
Because the prison hospital in Guantanamo has individuals who have been there for years who have suffered about the mistreatment they received and being force-fed by tubes going down their nose. I recall one of my first hunger strikes when I was there, being told about how the eating chair that's put in front of every cell where these hunger strikers are locked up. But I have a fascinating story about that, and a very brief one.
Go ahead.
I had a brigadier general who asked me one time, had I been in Unit C to visit the hunger strikers? And I said no. And what he said was that he had gone there and he had checked out the records of these hunger strikers. And this is one of the first hunger strikes. And he said that these hunger strikers, these people were designated to be hunger strikers, so they were locked away in these cells. And they were locked away in these cells for years. And as time passed, and the way it works in Guantanamo, is that there are various rotations. Soldiers come and they're replaced. Staff come and they're replaced all every 3 months or so. And over the years, no one ever thought of asking any of these hunger strikers, should they if they had been on strike, would they like to get out and get back to the mainstream of population? And so they had been there for years. And every day, three times a day, they were taken out of their cells and tied into these feeding chairs and strapped there, strapped for half, sit in those chairs for a good hour after they're force-fed. And what they do is they either put a quarter-inch or half-inch tube, depending upon your nose, and down into your stomach and then pour liquid. And imagine feeding someone like that every day, three times a day, month after month, year after year. And that they say they're doing that for the benefit of the prisoners themselves.
And this Brigadier General talked to you about this?
Yes.
Yes. Well, so Omar has now, with all of that trauma, that's one of the questions I want to ask you is, how is his mental state now? So all the trauma that from Bagram Air Base, Guantanamo, back in, put in a solitary confinement in Canada, how is his overall mental state? I know people who suffer from post-traumatic stress, and it can make you nervous and jumpy, and it can make sleeping very difficult. It can surprise you when it all of a sudden overtakes you as an individual. How is he doing? And has he received any real treatment for that?
Well, no, he hasn't. But Omar Khadr is a wonderful individual. How do I answer that? I could say to you that my experience of people that I have dealt with over the number of years who have been tortured, certainly there are those who will be forever damaged. But so many of those people who have been in Guantanamo that I have met, particularly the British former Guantanamo detainees, they, like Omar, harbor no anger. All they wish is to ensure that no one is ever mistreated like they have been mistreated. And so if you look at the British detainees, one is a lawyer and another is a human rights activist, but most of them are involved in some form of human rights. And so somehow or other, no matter what horror we perpetrate on either people like Omar Khadr, find a other level of compassion. And Omar Khadr has never, ever talks in any angry manner towards anybody. In fact, the only criticism I ever heard him make was that he felt that a certain member of his military defense team had misused him and lied to him. He is someone who is a blessing to both me and a blessing to any country that gets him when he gets out, or any community.
That's so good to hear. You know, I'm wondering if you can tell us about, is he receiving any education, and also has he been able to have any contact with his family since he's been in Canada?
Not much. But in terms of when our prisons, our Canadian prisons, are bereft of good programs for rehabilitation. And so what we have been able to do is, in Edmonton Institution, with the assistance of the warden, and God bless her, is to be able to send in volunteers to educate Omar on our own. And Omar he has a brain that is so desirous of learning. He's almost lustful in terms of his wishing to educate himself. And so every week we have professors from King's University, College in Edmonton, going into the prison and spending a number of hours. And so we have now raised his educational level to a grade 12. And Omar is so happy about that. But had we not done that, Omar Khadr would not have received any education. And of course, that would have worked against him when it comes time for parole.
Absolutely. It's so important to have education. And for someone who has a real lust for learning, as you're saying, and who was kept away from learning for so long, except in the worst, most direct, immediate way, I think that's really important. So I'm very glad to hear that there are volunteers. It also gives him contact with more and different people, which is so important if he's going to be able to have any sense of normalcy when he gets out of prison. Now,
I have arranged for, and it's ongoing, I've arranged for people, different people, from a Western, from young university students, some who are Western Muslims, to a novelist, to a professor, all different types of people. I've arranged for them to visit Omar, so he gets a sense of the outside world. And I would like to give you a little anecdote of Omar's view of the outside world. Or
yes, do.
Physical view. When Omar Khadr arrived in Edmonton by plane, he was then transferred into a small van with a small window slit at the side so he could look out. And he told me that he had seen green grass, that he had seen pickup trucks, and he had seen how some of our roads have little potholes. And what was startling about that was Omar Khadr's first observation of the outside world.
Wow.
Since he was deposited in Bagram many years ago. He was 15 then, and he was 27 when he was on that prison van coming.
Yeah, coming to prison to begin with.
And that's tragic. Now, you would ask me about his health. His health is not good. Omar is blind in one eye, partially blind in the other. So, although he has been in Canada since September 29, 2012, it is only now that the government is attempting to get him physical help for his injuries.
I would think he needs physical therapy at the very least.
Well, we have just recently had him assessed by a specialist for his shoulder. And that specialist wishes to operate as soon as possible. It is a serious operation. It takes months of recovering from it. It may mean replacing part of his shoulder. The bone is very damaged, and they're taking tissue samples of it to see if it's cancerous because of it's been infected for forever.
So this is the aftermath of him being wounded over 12 years ago.
Yes.
And never tortured during the time and refused pain relief while he was in that most vulnerable state initially. I have to admit, though, I'm shocked to hear he has this much damage without help.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Linda, I'm on the record of lecturing to people about how I've appeared in so many courts successfully for Omar Khadr, U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Supreme Court, Canadian Supreme Court. And what I say is, but don't run out to hire me, because I couldn't persuade my government or the Guantanamo authorities to provide him with protective glasses for his remaining good eye. And that takes me to the second injury he has, which is his remaining good eye. We have yet to get a specialist to look at his eye. We've had X-rays on his eye. And what is being discussed is some way of, I don't know how to put it medically, to try and rebuild part of his eye so that he can maintain some sight.
Okay.
But we're a long way from that getting someone to do any work for his eye.
At that point. So Dennis, we've only got a minute left, and so I need to wrap this part up. So he has significant health issues that you are working hard to address, and the most recent victory for him was that he was reclassified from maximum to medium security. Is that correct?
Yes.
So that means that he doesn't have to be in solitary, and he can have more relaxed incarceration rules, if I'm...
Yes, it means he will be transferred to a medium security prison. But the point of all that is this... We had the Canadian Ombudsman for Correctional Services Canada, and that is the person who oversees all these prisons. And he wrote a letter to the government saying that the classification of Omar as a maximum security prisoner was incorrect, that he is a minimum security prisoner, and it criticized the government for not addressing a plethora of evidence that demonstrated that Omar Khadr poses no threat to anybody and has no radical thoughts.
I also read, Dennis, that the polls of the public in Canada show that they are more favorable to Omar now than they were a few years ago. Is that your experience as well?
Overwhelmingly. I was in court recently on a habeas case, which is now going to the Court of Appeal, and the courtroom was not only packed, they had to open up other courtrooms for people to witness that my application. And when when it was all over at the end of the day, the people in the audience started cheering him as he was taken away.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. You know, we're going to keep on this story. I've been speaking with Dennis Edney, the attorney for Omar Khadr, who's just been named a medium security risk so he can go into a less difficult situation. He's got another 6 years in prison. We'll keep our eye on this story. Thank you so much for joining me today, Dennis Edney, and thank you for your work on behalf of Omar and others.
Well, I thank you, Linda, and I thank your listeners.
You're welcome, and thanks for joining KBOO today. Stay tuned for more of Political Perspectives, and thank you to our engineer, Rock.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. It is just about 10 o'clock, and coming up in 15 minutes, Flashpoints will begin. Today, internationally noted novelist Amy Tan speaks out about her battle against Lyme disease. And the Biggs Beat is back with a review of the new HBO series, Looking. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman interviews writer and literary showman Gary Steingart about his new memoir, Little Failure. And at 11:30, it's part two of Between the Covers with guests who helped produce I Am Not a Poet, being published by Street Roots. The guests are Cole Merkel, Street Roots vendor coordinator and leader of Street Roots Creative Writing Workshops, Vinny Kinsella, a volunteer copywriter, and contributing poet and homeless advocate Leo Rhodes. That's coming up on part two of Between the Covers at 11:30. First, though, it's Chris Andre up next at 10, hosting Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. Thank you, KBOO members, for your support. If you aren't a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today.
Tune in to The Prison Pipeline, Monday, January 27th, member of Leonard Peltier Defense Offense Committee to give us updates on Leonard Peltier and the upcoming march and rally in Tacoma, Washington. Prison Pipeline, Monday, January 27th, 6:30 p.m.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Thursday, January 23rd, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Just a heads up, a reminder, in Davos, Switzerland, our economic, our financial future is being divvied up amongst the powerful and the financial elite. So what a perfect time to become a member of KBOO and put your money in a place where it'll actually do some good. Or if you'd like to put it another way, where put your money somewhere where it can stir up trouble, where the people meeting in Davos. That said, a few headlines before we get into the program. Hopefully we'll have Norman Solomon on the air today to talk about the J Street lobby, originally intended as a sort of a counterbalance to AIPAC. But even as a counterbalance to AIPAC, any lobby of that nature is, of course, going to be in human rights terms, pretty much a conservative organization. Also, let's take a look at this. Oh, the humanities coming out of Syria. Well, you know, the same pictures, the same suffering has been coming out of occupied Palestine for over 50 years. We don't ever hear the world wringing its hands and twisting its hanky and dabbing away the tears over the Palestinians, do we? That said, in Cascadia, in Eugene, a consortium of advocates for the homeless are holding a press conference today. The name of their campsite for the homeless is Whoville. It's a great name, gotta say that. The citizens of